Hello and welcome to episode number 17 of AU to AZ. Except today it's AU to AZ to the UK. So with us today, Rodney, we've got Mark Anderson coming all the way from the UK.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Rodney. How are you?
I'm doing very well. You know, for me it's the beginning of the afternoon, and for you it's what?
It's just gone 8 p.m. in the evening. So yeah, I'm with you, Jenny.
And I'm early morning on tomorrow.
Blimey.
See, those Aussies always think they're ahead of us.
I know.
We try to be. So, Mark, can you tell us a bit about yourself? Because there'll be some people listening who are saying, now, who is Mark Anderson?
Okay. Well, I'm an educator from the UK. I teach computing and ICT. I'm a big fan, advocate for use of mobile devices, whatever they are, to support and enhance learning across the curriculum. I'm an Apple Distinguished Educator. I'm a Google Certified Teacher. I'm a Microsoft Certified Educator as well. I've been really lucky to work in a number of schools where we've had one-to-one iPad, and I've been doing that for a number of years. I'm also an education consultant. So today, for example, I was working with a school looking at effective use of ICT and technology across the curriculum. And I had the opportunity to spend some time with the phys ed department, looking at their use of iPad, and then some time with the math department as well, looking at use of iPad with them there. And outside of my sort of day job, I'm a bit of a sort of a teaching and learning and technology geek, really. So I do a lot of sharing of ideas. I blog a lot. I tweet a fair amount at ICT Evangelist. So my blog is ictevangelist.com. And I'd like to share ideas and good practice. I wrote a book called The Perfect ICT Every Lesson, which looks at how we can use technology in every lesson to enhance learning, and give some strategies, such as using the SAMR model and what have you, as a vehicle to try and support teaching and learning with technology. And that's kind of where I'm at, really, because I think the technology has got the power to transform how learning takes place in our classrooms. And, you know, I don't have all the answers. And certainly, you know, where I'm at with my journey with it all has been through, you know, conversations with educators like yourselves, because together we can, you know, help move things forward. So that's kind of where I'm at, really, but just wanting to help transform education in whatever way that I can.
See, Rodney, I told you I'd found us a star for our podcast.
Yes, you did. Now, Ginny, last.
I do all right.
I do all right, he says. A bit humble, huh? One of the things that I remember is you talked, Jennifer talked about going to the UK. Did she come to see you, Mark?
We met at a conference in Bristol. A conference that happens there every year, called the Southwest ICT Conference. And it was really nice that we sat down, Jenny and I, a few times during the day with another educator called Mark Allen. And he's Ed in the Clouds on Twitter. He's a lovely chap. And it was just good to sit down and sort of chew the cud a little bit, as it were. If that's a colloquialism, that it's just sitting down and having a chat, basically. It was just good to get perspectives from Jenny, really, because, like I said, together, you know, we can learn and do so much more than by ourselves. We're better when we work together, and so getting other perspectives, you know, really helps move the whole conversation and the thinking behind the learning forward, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
And it was another case of people we know on Twitter and meeting them face to face and really enriching the relationship and, you know, just getting connections even stronger.
Absolutely.
That's right. So since then, I'm not as regular as you guys with your podcast, but I do a thing from time to time called App Smash Live. And so we use Google Hangouts on air, and a few of us get together, talk about the work we're doing and how we can use technology with our students in our classrooms, and how we can sort of use multiple applications to try and sort of create greater learning outcomes from it. And so, Jenny, you've been involved in a few of those as well, haven't you?
I have come on board for a couple of those. They've been a lot of fun. I'm not a real fan on having a camera on you. Because Rodney will tell you I'm always doing a few other things while I'm speaking. So once the camera's on me, I forget and I'm probably not even looking at the camera and doing other things.
So one of our tenets that we do on our podcast is comparing and contrasting things that happen in Australia as well with things that are happening in the United States, particularly in Arizona. So maybe if you really quickly can get us up to speed of your school structure, who is there a public school system? Is there a charter school system, a separate system? And how is that funded? And also, how does the education tend to pan out between those two different schools?
we've got three really now, or four actually. So in the state school system, in the state school system, we've got what are called free schools. We have academies, and then we have state schools. Funding for all three of those comes from central government, but the way that they're organised and managed is slightly different. So a free school is what you would know as a charter school, really. Okay, it's very autonomous. It runs itself. It has to adhere to certain things from state, but a more of a free rein as to how it is run and managed and organised and all the rest of it. An academy gets its funding directly from government, and it can manage that budget as and how it wants to. But an academy has to follow the national curriculum here in the United Kingdom. Mm-hmm. The other type of school, state school, is a standard state school. And these get their budgets devolved from a local area government, like a local authority. So the government will send the money to the local authority, and the local authority will then pass that money into the school. And more and more schools in the UK are moving over to academisation, but there are still a large number of state schools which aren't academies at all. And those are the three government-funded schools. And then we have got a private school system here, which raises its monies from benefactors and from the fees that they charge to the students, or the families of the students who attend those schools. So those are the four main types of school that we have here in the UK. And that's looking at what you would call sort of K-12 level. It's the same sort of thing what we call primary. Our year system's different as well here. So young people who are 4 to 5 years old will be in what we call reception class. And then they start after that in year one. And the primary school runs from year one to year six. And within the primary school, they tend to have what's called infants and juniors. So the infant school, which is like the lower part of the primary school, would be reception, and then year one, two, and three. And then you've got the second half of the primary called the juniors, which would be years four, five, and six. But lots and lots of schools. Like my son's in year one, and his school is just one school, and it runs through right from reception right through to year six. And then at the end of year six, you apply to go to your secondary school, and again, you've got a raft of options there available to you.
Yeah, that's really interesting, Mark. I was thinking trying to convert that to Australian schools, and I'd say in our government schools we would line up with the academy model.
Yeah.
We'd be going on that academy model. I'm wondering with your government-funded schools, do parents pay any fees?
No.
No fees at all?
No.
Okay, because our what about for materials?
Well, not really. Okay. No.
Excursions?
And they're voluntary as well. And we have, through our state system, we have a thing here called pupil premium and free school meals.
Yeah.
And so for those families which are in a bit of hardship and what have you, they can apply for free school meals. And if you apply for free school meals and you're then eligible, then you get a lot of support. So, for example, in a school that I've just finished working at, we had one-to-one iPad there, and the money that the school gets extra for those students who are on free school meals. Part of the money that came into the school to support those families and helping sort of bring that down the digital divide and so forth and so on. And one of the things that these students on free school meals get is their own iPad given to them, whereas families and students who aren't on free school meals don't. They have to contribute into those. But again, it is a scheme that you don't have to jump into if you don't want to, but families overwhelmingly do.
Yeah. What about the private schools there? The private school system there, does the government give any money to the private school system?
I don't think so, but I don't know for sure.
Okay, because our private school system is getting more and more money from the government.
Right.
As we speak. Each government that comes in tends to decide, let's give them more. And the percentage, right. The percentage has risen quite alarmingly about what level of funding they get. So that's interesting.
I don't think they get any money at all of any sort of significance, really. Mm. Not in the scheme of things, no.
Mm.
But I've not worked in the private sector, so I'm not 100% sure.
Right.
So based upon your definition of how the UK schools work, our schools are more of the standard state schools, where the government gives the local entity money, and then the school, the local area, then dictates what they do with that money. We have what are called districts. And so each school district has a lump of money that they've received, and then they parse it out to the different school sites as they see fit, based upon numbers and other things like that. So it's kind of interesting that that it's set up in that way. We also have a private school system, but our private schools are broken into like academies that they don't have to. That's more they're more of private schools.
Mm-hmm.
But also, we also have a private schools are also parochial. So there's benefactors that say, "Hey, here's what we're going to do." But those benefactors could be people, or they could be corporations that create right. these schools. So I'm understanding to be similar there in the UK too, right?
Pretty much, yeah. Okay. It's quite interesting because I've got a bit of an insight into both American schools and Australian schools, because I was lucky. I've been lucky in my career to visit both countries with my teacher hat on. So back early in my career, I went to Texas and to a place called Lubbock, Buddy uh-huh. Holly's hometown, and I was there for a week, and we were looking at how the schools there in the district there deliver citizenship education within their schools. So that was really interesting. It gave me real insight how schools then sort of worked in the US. And then more recently, say 4 years ago, maybe 5 years ago now, I was lucky enough to go to Adelaide. And we were looking at sustainability there, and I got to visit a whole lot of schools and colleges and what have you there, and looking at the Australian system. The Australian system is such a big country, isn't it, Jenny? The thing which really struck me with the Australian system was how different it is across your different states.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I guess you'd have that in America as well, Rodney.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because your states... all your education is run from your state, and then it's given it to the different districts.
Right.
Yeah. So in Arizona, it's going to be different to California.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's even different from my school district to a district to our south or a district to our north. They're different.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So, so with that said, my next question then leads to professional development. In order for a teacher to get a position at a school, how many years of formal education do they have to have? Is there a type of curriculum that they have to go through in order through a state school that they have to attend to licensing? And what's the general consensus from being a student to being a teacher in the UK system?
Okay, so At age 16 in the UK, students study a series of exams called GCSEs. That's a General Certificate of Secondary Education.
Mm-hmm.
And they normally do quite a few of those, ranging from sort of 9 to 13 different subjects.
Wow.
But that's changing at the moment in terms of how they're graded and assessed and everything. There's a lot of fluctuation in UK education at the moment. But with that, say students will get their various grades and what have you, and then they'll go into what we call a sixth form. So that's sort of from ages, well, they'll be 16 when they start in September, but they'll be 18 by the time they finish. And normally, most students will do three, maybe four A levels, advanced levels, at post 16, sort of post compulsory education. And the success that they have in those three or four subjects then dictates what university they can go to based upon the grade they get and what have you. You know, we've got loads of universities in the UK, ranging from, you know, your Oxfords and Cambridges, through to Manchester, through to wherever, you know. And when you're at university in the UK, there's a variety of degrees that you can do. So the degree route is often the route that you do. It depends what degree you do.
Right.
But a bachelor degree in the UK is normally 3 years. My route into education was a bachelor degree called a Bachelor of Education degree, and the Bachelor of Education degree is 4 years, because the main routes into teaching involve it's a 4-year process. Okay, I'll try and explain this clearly. Hopefully, I will. But basically, across those 4 years, you'll have 3 years which are linked to your specialist subject development and training. You and a year spent looking at pedagogy and teaching and learning and all the rest of it. So one popular route is to do a 3-year specific subject degree. Let's say that's a BSc, which is a Bachelor of Science degree, or Bachelor of Arts, a BA. Okay, and then you'll do a year full-on postgraduate course in education. So the 3-year degree plus the postgraduate course constitutes 4 years. My course, however, the Bachelor of Education degree, was 4 years. So what happened there was, rather than having a full-on year at the end of it all, my teaching practice and teaching and learning training and all the rest of it was spread across the 4 years. So that by the end of the 4 years, I'd spent a year doing the training, but it was interwoven with all my specialist subject knowledge and all the rest of it. I really liked that route because what it did, it gave me across those 4 years the opportunity to develop and grow and practice far more, because I was able to be more reflective and what have you.
Right.
In my experience now as an educator who's, you know, been a head of department and assistant head and what have you, you know, I've worked with trainees from the local university who are doing their full-on 1 year after they've done their 3-year subject-specific degree. And it is really hard work. It's really full on. It's hard enough being a teacher at the best of times without having to do all the work, all the planning, all the stress, all the worry. It's a tough gig being a teacher, you know, and having to do that, plus all going to the lectures, doing their action research, writing their theses and all the rest of it. And say doing that at the end of doing that in 1 year all the time whilst being in school as well, you know, is a tough ask. In recent times, there have been quite a bit of a shortage in terms of certain subject-specific teachers and recruiting high-quality candidates into high-quality graduates, into education in the UK. So an organisation called Teach First was created, and Teach First is a 1-year course which sort of takes the best graduates and works really intensively with them. Often you're looking at students who've come from Oxford and Cambridge, people who traditionally might not have thought of going into education, but are given this intensive training to work in schools and what have you. And that seems to be getting some success, but there's, say, a lot of quite hearty debates about Teach Firsters and how they are and what have you. But in my experience, I know I've worked in schools with a number of Teach Firsters, and I found them to be, you know, people who are, you know, just like me in terms of being 100% focused on, you know, student outcomes and you know, really driven to improve outcomes for students. And I think, you know, if we can recruit, high quality graduates into our system. It doesn't matter whether you do a 3-year plus one or a 4-year spread across or a 3-year then intensive stuff. It doesn't really matter to me, really. It's all about making sure you've got people who've had a really good experience are coming into the system for the right reasons, you know?
What about you, so, Rodney? How does it work in the US?
The way that he really likes is pretty much the way that we have it, in that the teachers, how do I say this? We have secondary, which goes through high school, and then from there the kids can choose to go or not to go into a university. It's pretty much up to them and what they decide. If they do choose to go to university, they may or may not have taken what's called the SAT. Scholastic Aptitude Test, or the ACT, the American College or Certification Testing. But you can still get into a university based upon either those scores and some type of academic work that you did in high school, or even with a high school diploma. And then from there, you get to choose wherever you want to go. American education is more of a here's everything. Excuse me, here's everything, and you choose where you're going to go. And from there, if you want to go into teaching, you can. There's no scores that are going to keep you out. If you think it's something that's really good for you and you really want to do it, then you have that opportunity. Personally, I went through what's called a professional development school. So I had all of my basic courses done. And from there, I took a 1-year intensive course. Sometimes in the morning, early morning, I would go to a class. During the day, we would have we would actually work with students in the classrooms. And then the other part of the day, we would have other parts of the class with application, action research, and the other course studies that we did. And that was for a complete year. You really couldn't do anything else, because every single day you were in class, you were giving class, or you were doing some type of work to catch up, to do some type of paper or reading or such. So that's my personal walkthrough into education.
Yeah, well, here in Australia, we have our P to 12 schools. And a lot of primary schools are P, which is like your reception class to grade 6. And then a lot of our high schools are year 7 to year 12. Here in Bendigo, though, we are a little bit different than most areas in Australia. All our high schools, government high schools in Bendigo, are just year 7 to year 10. And then in Bendigo, we have a senior high with about 2,000 students. And senior high is year 11 and 12 only. And at the end of year 12, all students sit exams for all their subjects, and in some way it's put together, and they come up with a score, a TER score, tertiary entrance record, I think that means, score. And different courses in all our universities in Australia require a certain score to get into that course. So they can compete for courses all over Australia. They have to put in their application well before the exams and everything on what their hopes are. They put in a few different preferences, and then it all depends on that score into which university they get into. Our teacher training is different for secondary and primary. Mm-hmm. Primary training tends to be the 4-year course with teaching all throughout the 4 years. And secondary training, people who do that might do a degree in some area, and then a 3-year degree, and then do a 1-year called a dip ed, where they do all their teaching, focus on teaching and learning. But there is another system that's begun as well. It's called Teach for Australia. This is really interesting because Teach for Australia is for teaching in disadvantaged secondary schools for 2 years. So schools where they are disadvantaged and they're having trouble getting staffing, you can do a 6-week course and then go and teach in these schools. And throughout your 2 years, you'll do some more intense training with them and end up with a master of teaching. So it's interesting and does cause a lot of debate in Australia.
Sounds like our Teach for America system.
Yes. So interesting that, yeah, so there's a lot of conversations about teacher training here in Australia as well, and the universities that are running the courses are, you know, looking at changes. And, you know, when we get the students out at school, they're always grumbling and about things as usual. But I think one of the big differences with the students these days, of course, as well, is they have really big work commitments. Whereas when I went to uni in the old days, there weren't many people that worked at all. You just went to uni and that was it. Whereas these days, most of the kids are working two jobs or whatever, plus doing uni, plus doing a school placement. So it is really full on.
The bit that I missed about the UK is that when you have finished your sort of training, doing your PGCE or your four-year BEd or whatever it is you've done, you're then classed as what's called an NQT, which is a newly qualified teacher. Hmm. And for you to sort of get your wings, as it were, to be a fully qualified teacher, you have to have then successfully completed a full year working full-time in a school. Now, an NQT in a school in the UK does get a slightly reduced timetable, and schools have a responsibility to provide extra sort of support and what have you during that first year. It's not a lot of extra time, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But there is a bit of extra time.
Yeah.
The controversy in the UK, though, is that in academies and certainly in private schools, obviously, but in academies and free schools, schools are not obliged to hire teachers who have got what's called QTS, as qualified teacher status. So the wings that you get at the end of your NQT year is this thing called QTS. But if you're an academy, or if you're, like I say, a free school or a private school, you can hire whoever you want to stand in front of teachers. You don't have to have a teacher with this qualified teacher status. And so that causes quite a bit of debate and what have you, as you might imagine.
So my next question that I have to ask is, okay, we've talked about the formal education up to getting a job. Afterwards, what happens to help teachers to become to be better and to stay on top of current pedagogies, teaching practices, as well as integrating technology, which is what you do?
Well, it's very hit and miss in the UK. You know, it really does depend on where you work. There's no real sort of national program. Schools will often devolve part of their budget to professional development. Schools are allowed to have what used to be called Baker Days, but we call them Inset Days now. It's called Baker Days after the guy in government who sort of initiated them. But lots of schools have Inset Days now. And so that's what I've been doing today. I was at a school in Birmingham. It was their Inset Day, and it was a day where staff could have you know, some professional development, working with me, working with them, giving them ideas and training and support and what have you, on using technology effectively across the curriculum. But schools, you know, choose their own foci. And you know, different schools do it in different ways. You know, some schools don't do, they'll have maybe Inset Days, which some schools won't have any at all, and they'll disaggregate it. And so rather than having any days off school, the school year will be slightly shorter by sort of 5 days, and staff undertake the training in their own time. Or, you know, special twilight sessions are put on and staff undertake those in their own time. And they get a few extra days holiday at the end of the year. But again, the way in which it's all organised is very much down to the individual school. So one school I worked at, the inset was the CPD time was mostly disaggregated.
Yeah.
And able to go and attend whichever sessions linked to your professional development needs. You were enabled and encouraged to do action research based upon the training you'd had, and then report back that as part of your performance management cycle. And sort of share your learning with the rest of the school. So when you did have an inset day, if there was one, it was a sort of a bring and brag kind of thing where you would, you know, come and talk about the things you've been doing and what you've been learning, and so you can share your impact across the whole school. I think that's quite a nice model, really. But say schools don't have that at all. You know, they'll have their sort of 4 or 5 inset days per year. They'll get speakers in and trainers in, and everyone has to have that sort of one size fits all sort of thing. So it's very much down to the individual schools, and certainly in the UK, more and more educators are turning to they're taking control of their own CPD. That's what I certainly did, and that's how I'm at. When I was launching and then looking at and researching use of mobile technologies, you know, I had to turn outwards. You know, I had to speak to other people who were doing it already, mm-hmm. and speaking educators like Greg Kulewicz in the States, and
yes,
and Fraser Spears in Scotland, you know, people who've been doing it already, to try and, you know, look at how they've been doing it, to learn from them, and using things like Twitter and blogging to share my thoughts and ideas about where I'm at and what have you. And it really helped me. But, you know, that's how more and more people are turning to their CPD. But that's not school endorsed. It's not school backed. It's not paid for by the school. It's down to the individual as to how, you know, how much they want to do it for themselves, really.
But so that runs into the TeachMeets a lot, Mark?
Right.
Say that again, sorry?
So that runs into the TeachMeets a lot, I guess, because they're fairly popular, aren't they?
Yeah, so I've run a few myself. Not my last school, but the school before that, I ran one. I did 6 there at that school, and it was phenomenal. You know, the first one that I ran there, we had sort of 30 maybe teachers turn up for it. By the end, though, it was great. It was just through word of mouth and use of Twitter. But I mean, obviously, the UK is nowhere near as big as the US or Australia. But if you know anything about British geography, you know, the school I was at, just outside Bristol, and we had people coming from like the far reaches of Swansea in Wales. Some people travelled from London. Guy flew over from Jersey. A couple came over from the Isle of Wight. A guy came down from Yorkshire, and we had some people from Leeds. You know, and we had 250 people there in the last one that we did. And, you know, they travelled all that way to come and share their practice and to learn from others. And it was just amazing. If you look on YouTube at youtube.com/TM Clevedon, you can see all of the short talks, the seminars in the session, and the keynote speakers. They're all there for you to watch back again. It was just amazing. So empowering to see people giving up their own time, you know, and actually many schools facilitating, you know, paying for their teachers to come down and attend it and so forth and so on. It was really groundbreaking. You know, it wasn't your average teach me where a few teachers from a local area get together. It was just something else.
How long did it go for, Mark?
It ran over probably 3 years.
I mean, when you came to a teach meet, how long did that actually
So if the last one, if you take it, that one as an example,
yep.
It was started about 5:30 and was done by 8.
Oh, okay.
And within that time, we had a sort of 45-minute keynote. We then broke to seminars, and there were 6 seminars, there might have been 8 seminars that went on. And then it came back, and it was networking time for some bring and brag and sort of show and tell and that sort of stuff. And then we'd have like an hour, hour and a half of really short, snappy, traditional sort of teach me sessions.
Yep.
Yes. Yes, I was actually had the opportunity to be a part of one of those. It was really neat.
Yeah, so Mark, how would you say the use of our technology is going with schools generally in the UK?
It's a tale of two cities, really, to be honest. Mm. And I think it links to a lot in terms of the confidence of the teachers that are in the schools. You've got those teachers who are embracing technology and they're using their smartphones to engage in ways that they wouldn't have been able to do previously, you know, getting on, like I say, on Twitter and so forth and so on. And then there's those who don't, you know, their phones are their phones for making phone calls and maybe texting somebody once in a blue moon. And that sort of disparity between the two ends of the spectrum, you know, and so there's ranges in between and what have you. But it really does depend. So some schools, you know, it technology's everywhere. Some schools, you know, it's just the complete opposite. People book themselves into computer labs, you know, they've got to book them 3 weeks in advance to get in there so they can use them and things, and you know, That's kind of where it's at.
And would
really.
You say that's is because of the testing?
I don't know necessarily if it's about because of the testing, but certainly there is a lot of pressure on schools to perform in terms of their results. Mm. And, you know, it can be seen to be quite a brave move. In the UK, there's quite a school of thought, an even more growing school of thought about sort of more traditional didactic teaching, which mm-hmm. doesn't involve blended learning or anything like that. Mm. You got a book written last year called Progressively Worse. tore apart progressive education in his mind. You know, he was, it's just... Mm. People have different opinions about how students can best learn. And it's great to be able to talk about it and debate it. But
yes.
End of the day, you know, I've always been in the mind that as teachers we have toolkits. And actually, you know, when I'm working with my students, there are times when I want them to be sat in silence and actually, you know, learning's tough. And I want them to sit there for 10 minutes in silence working because they've really got to focus. But there are other times when group work's more appropriate. There are other times where, you know, sharing your things online or reflecting or looking back at your work or commenting on others for peer assessment, you know, all these different things that we can do are what we should do, you know, so that we're able to, you know, as master professionals, you know, we should be able to do those sorts of things. If I think about TPAC as a teaching and learning model, you know, as a teacher, you should be a master of technology and pedagogy and content. And one of the things that it says in TPAC, isn't it? It says about the ability to know when to use technology and when not to use technology. And when I'm walking around and doing learning walks and looking in classrooms, you know, I'm really inspired when I go into a classroom and see students not using technology because the teacher's been able to say, well, actually, it's not appropriate for this task and we're doing this time because of this and that and the other. You know, it's about being a master craftsman as a teacher, using the toolkits that we've got so that you're able to bring about the best learning outcomes for your kids. That's my sort of thinking.
Yeah, I'm right with you there, Mark. I think it's a really great way to go. We've sort of gone the full circle where, you know, at one stage you had to do everything using technology or it wasn't seemed to be the right thing, whereas really I think there's a place for it and a place for not using technology.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm. Well, it's been a great discussion with you, Mark. Interesting to see how the different systems work. Did you have any more questions, Rodney?
No, I didn't. I was just contemplating just how similar our three continents are.
How
really similar. I mean, you said the technology use in the UK is a tale of two cities, and that is really indicative of how it is here. Actually, I did have one more question.
Yeah.
Do you find, Mark, do you find more technology in a specific type of school than another, or is it spread across all four?
I can't really comment on free schools because they've not been running too long, and you know, there aren't that many of them.
Okay.
What we're tending to find in the private schools is that lots and lots and lots of them are going for some kind of personal device adoption. So if I think about the Stephen Peirce Foundation and what have you, you know, these sorts of schools where there's a fair amount of money available, then it's a great way to move forward and support enhanced learning. So if we take the Stephen Peirce Foundation, for example, all their courses are on for all their students are on iTunes U. And not just for the students in the school, but it's open there, public access. Anyone can do those courses and learn from them as well. So there's certainly a lot going on there within the private sector, but more and more schools are looking to do it in one way, shape or form. One way which is quite popular in the UK is a system called BYOD or BYOT, right. Which you may have heard of, bring your own device, bring your own tablet and what have you.
Yeah.
And the way in which the BYOD thing works in schools is, again, sort of very sort of tailored to what that school's vision is. So a purist kind of BYOD thing would be, you know, bring whatever, you know, whereas some schools will say, well, we've got a BYOD policy, but in order for us to better use sort of consistent sort of pieces of technology, then you need to bring in one of these five devices. you know?
Right.
There are various sorts of models where schools will support families with getting a tablet or the Chromebook or whatever it is. But then there's other schools which are completely Chromebook, other schools completely iPad. I'm doing a conference in February, a Chromebook event, where it's at a school where all the students have got Chromebooks. You know, there's lots of stuff going on. But I think really, in answering your question, I think where we're seeing the most of it really is in the private sector.
Yeah, gotcha. I'm hoping to do a little bit of BYOD myself this year, Mark. So yeah. It's going to be very interesting.
The thing I like most about BYOD, and then it's certainly getting more and more pervasive within, you know, your singular structures like your iPad or whatever, is the move that Google's having.
Mm.
You know, Google App for Education is becoming something which is more and more a staple for.
Yeah.
You know, schools that are iPad or Chromebook or whatever, because it's that backbone that sits across everything, and that's a commonality that I'm seeing more and more, and it's so powerful, and Google is so heavily invested in it, and you know, fair play to them, and the development of things like Google Classroom, and the various apps that are available, you know, on both platforms, you know, that's really exciting for me, because it takes out. It sort of levels the playing field, doesn't it? So whether you're using iPhone or whether you're using a Nexus or whatever you're using, a Chromebook or whatever it is, you know, you can still work collaboratively together, all the rest of it, you know, it levels that playing field, doesn't it? So that's the really exciting thing for me on that front.
It does, yes. So it'll be a very interesting year to see how it all goes. We'd better let you go, Mark, though, so you can enjoy the rest of your evening. So thank you very much for... Wow. Sharing some time with us.
Thank you so very much.
And thank you both, Rodney and Jenny, for asking me. Very kind of you. Thank you.
We may have to take some time to get him to come back and to talk some more, because I have lots more questions now.
Okay, you're going to write them all down, Rodney, and we'll have another session with AU to AZ to UK. Well, that ends our talk with Mark across the miles around the world. We hope you've enjoyed our talk with Mark Anderson in episode number 17, and we hope to have Mark back again to give us some of his tips and great activities that he does using technology in education.
Bye.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Bye.